Welcome to Talking Success, the podcast series that focuses on everything fintech. I'm your host, Alan Franks, and each week I'll be joined by a series of experts in the field who have a wealth of knowledge to share. It's time to meet this week's guest, so grab a coffee and let's start talking success. Hello, everyone, and welcome to yet another episode of Talking Success. Right, I'm really excited about this one because this is a subject that's very close to my heart, very close to my interest levels, and that's the whole world of crypto. And I'm delighted, really delighted to be joined by Hannes, who is the country manager here for Binance. So the country manager of Binance for South Africa. I'm going to let him do a proper intro in a second, but I think the whole world of crypto, certainly over the last few years, has just gone crazy. Just before we started recording, Hannes was saying that, a year in the world of crypto is like a dog year, and it's like 7 years in the real world. And that could be further from the truth. So we're going to unpack loads of different things. I must just say before we start this, there is no financial advice given at all during this podcast. We are not financial advisors. We are not going to be talking about different types of coins or anything like that. So this is an info full heavy session where we're going to dive into Binance. We're going to dive into some regulations here in South Africa, which have changed. We're going to talk about some of the community work that Binance are doing and some of the educational work. And this really is about I suppose educating anyone that's listening about Binance as a business and really what their interest is here in South Africa and perhaps slightly beyond. So, Hannes, great to have you on board. As I said to you, it's been about a year since we last spoke, just as you joined Binance. So, in my reckonings, that's what 7 years you've now been in situ. How's it going? Give a quick intro because you've got a super interesting background. So, quick intro from you, and then we'll dive straight in.
Hey, Darren, and thanks very much for the introduction. So, I'm Hannes Wessels. I'm the general manager for Southern Africa, but very close to what you've said. It's really South Africa at this stage, but we are looking at some of the adjacent countries at the moment. That's for Binance. That's our bigger ecosystem. And, for us as a firm, it's about not only putting up a shop in South Africa for Binance, but connecting people or obviously getting them onto the blockchain and connecting them to the rest of the network. It's that wider user adoption that's important to us and that we are very excited about.
Amazing. Let's start with a really complex, boring part, right, which is sort of regulatory and compliance. And I mean that with the greatest of respect to the SARB and to the FSCA and anyone else that regulates financial services here in South Africa. But it'd be fair to say that, regulation is ever-evolving. New technology, new ways of paying, new ways of moving money around, different asset classes, et cetera. We're seeing a seismic shift here in South Africa. Back end of last year, there was an announcement by the SARB that the crypto as a class is now an asset class. They've classed it as an asset. Can you unpack that? Can you talk a bit about what that means? To a layman who doesn't really understand what an asset class is and what it was and what it could be, can you unravel it a little bit?
Yeah, I think thanks, Darren. I think the big debate at that stage was: is it a currency or is it a financial asset, more like a share, an Aspen share, a Prosus share, an Anglo American share, etc. And I think that type of determination is important because you then get into tax evaluations. I mean, if you hold dollars for a number of years, I talk about a correction, but I think the tax treatment of that will be different than to that of shares, whereas crypto is treated similar to shares as a financial asset. And I think that differentiation, it's an important one to make as you go onto that regulatory journey. So where we are from a exchange control perspective is that if we all have that 1 million rand discretionary allowance and your crypto purchases is part of that, you can then obviously apply to the SARS for a 10 million rand allowance. Obviously, all your tax stuff needs to be up to date and et cetera. So that's a good departure point. You then get into the regulation of assets themselves. We've seen the SEC comes after our US ARM Coinbase and some of those others due to the nature of the financial assets, and that's obviously a court case that's ongoing, but that definition is important. And then it's also about the conduct issues. So how does people who sell crypto in a country conduct themselves? How do they treat the customers? What rights do the customers have, more importantly? And that's the one we've seen South Africa now move forward and say, okay, the FSCA will now require all CASPs, crypto asset service providers, to be licensed financial services providers, so FSPs. And that window is open from the 1st of June to the 30th of November. So there's been some recent Bloomberg press that 20 firms have applied so far. We are in the process of applying, and we've made very good headway in terms of getting all our policies and everything ready for South Africa. So that's going to happen. And why is that important? In a regulated country, it gives the user access to someone. So if something goes wrong, you can go to the regulator saying, this is what happened. Mm-hmm. I was either given bad advice, or I traded on a bad platform, or I was defrauded for reasons X, Y, Z, etc. It gives the users access to a regulator who then investigates. I've met with them late last year, and they talked us through the whole process. And you've got an investigations department who then look at each case in detail. And then you have an enforcement department. So if something went wrong and firm X did something bad, they will then either give you a fine or suspend your license to give advice, etc. So it's taken very seriously. They do an excellent job about it. But that's the important part of it. You need to be, you need to have that recourse to someone, and that puts everybody on the same level. I think so. First thing, the user access to a regulator, and then it puts all the firms on that equal level where everybody needs to behave at a certain standard or better. Sure. And I think especially for crypto, that's an important development, and it's an important part of the forward journey.
And then, I think when I've been on the Binance platform, I've been a bit bamboozled by a lot of the products that are kind of offered and gone, wow, I don't even know what this is. Does each product need to be regulated in its own right, or are there certain products within the Binance suite that sort of fall into one category and you say, actually, we're now certified and regulated for this particular category? I'd love to be able to quote to you all the different types of products that you guys have on your platform, but I can't remember them. But there was loads, and they really did bamboozle me.
So we like to take that portfolio approach where we declare all the products we will avail. Because it's early days for crypto, the FISCO will develop over time, obviously, expertise in each of those product areas. But like all countries, that's going to take time. So we declare all the products that we will make available to users. But the big differentiation comes between our derivative product, because that's particularly high risk. And we ask all users to acknowledge that and also educate themselves so that when they do use the product, they fall in that more sophisticated, can I say, upper tier of our users, and then the rest of the products. And that's, in our case, that derivative partnership is with a firm called Five West. They're an OTC desk for crypto. They already registered, and we do that on a juristic partnership basis. The rest, we will then apply for our own license to make sure we cover all those spaces. But yeah, I think to have a per product type of approach will take time. I know why you're asking the questions, because at the moment, if you look at the product categories, you've got long-term deposits, short-term deposits, insurance product, assurance products, etc. And that's because the regulator itself were basically built around the financial services industry as far as these insurance, short-term insurance, life assurance, and banking. And now, obviously, they're broadening it. So I do expect the knowledge to grow as they go down this journey. And I do expect the product categories to widen to include certain parts of crypto. But I think that's going to take a year or two.
Yeah. Let's move on a little bit from the regulatory side, because we could probably spend 2 hours talking about that. You mentioned something just now about, educating your customers when it comes to some of the more advanced products. But let's take it back a step. So when it comes to educating the population on cryptocurrency and alternative methods, how do you at Binance go around that? Because I think if we wind the clock back, even just a couple of months, people got a bit afraid with the FTX scandal that happened, and there was this bit of uncertainty about is this just a whole one big scam? How did we build confidence in the sector, and what is Binance doing specifically here in South Africa to try and educate the wider population on the value or the utilization or the user cases behind cryptocurrency?
Money is all around us, and we think about it more than almost every other aspect of our lives. But how can we make more of it, and what's our drive for building wealth beyond just the numbers in our bank account? Join us on the Make More podcast as our host, Matt Heslin, brings to you a dynamic lineup of experts in the world of investing, business, health, and beyond. Together, they unpack the secrets to not just surviving, but thriving in today's economy. It's about more than just wealth. It's about crafting life experiences, seizing opportunities, and building a legacy. Subscribe now to the Make More with Matt Heslin podcast and join us every week for new expert insights and inspiration.
Yeah, very good question. So it all starts with the education bit. And for us, I'm going to be bold and say I think we've probably spent the most resources on the education bit of any crypto firm. And you can measure that by going to our Academy page. So you either, if you type Binance Academy into your search engine or academy.binance.com, it'll take you to that page as well. Last time I checked, more than 368 articles on different parts of crypto, different products in crypto, different aspects of crypto. It explains stuff like the blockchain, proof of work, proof of stake, those things in very simplistic language to get the beginners on board.
Yep.
And that type of stuff, I think, is vital. I see an information or an education adoption curve even before I see the technology adoption curve. You know, and I would ask anybody who's interested in this is free. You don't need to pay for it. So go onto the website, educate yourself. If it's not for you, it's not for you. And I think no business wants a user that doesn't want to be on the site. So if you feel it's not for you and it doesn't make sense, well, you know what? You still leave a more informed individual. But if you do have an interest, register, you know, go through the process and start with something small. You know, send a friend 10 rands worth of crypto as an argument. You know, the fees are so low that it's not a case if you pay a base fee and then incremental from there. It's actually very cheap. And it just gets people into that habit of transacting with crypto, which I think if you look at the initial Satoshi Nakamoto white paper, that was the intent behind it. A peer-to-peer payment system. And that's one of our product areas is that peer-to-peer payment system to transact on an individual basis. But the education bit, very, very important for us. And we ask everybody to please use that resource. We put a lot of time, money, and energy into it to make sure it's of a very high quality, yet of a simplicity that people can easily absorb it.
So you have it on the website, so it's fully accessible to anyone. How are you going about to driving people to that website? What sort of campaigns are you using? Is it more awareness? How are you getting sort of new consumers who don't understand or maybe have a very basic understanding of what a cryptocurrency is or crypto, an exchange is, and getting them sort of into this platform? How are you going about doing that?
So there's two main channels there. So a lot of our advertising campaigns stress the importance of our Academy website.
Right.
And I think the bigger one for us is our community. It's a very different to the traditional finance space where in crypto you do have very good communities. And don't underestimate the power of these communities as a feedback tool, a temperature tool. You know, how are people experiencing the product currently? In the days of FTX, you could sense there was a lot of anxiety. It gives you an excellent mechanism to stay in contact with your users. People tell you very quickly, very often before you know your platform has an issue, the user tells you your platform's got an issue. And that's just fantastic to have that level of connectivity. But also, I think we ask people to join that community so you can get access to all the resources. We promote some product areas from an education perspective, some weeks, some of the others. And it's just free. You know, we live in a world where information is almost universally available, almost, because you just need to have a phone in your pocket. And these websites are all designed to be available in your mobile as it is on your home PC or as it is on a laptop or anything. You know, it's all tailored for the device that you're on. So it's only the willingness to learn that will differentiate people, you know, the willingness to educate yourself on something someone else doesn't want to. So I think the days of a big university library or a big city library with, you know, encyclopedia, and you had to go look something up. Even though it was accessible to most people, it was still difficult because you had to know which book to get. Nowadays, you just go, say, okay, I want to learn about this, and you know, your search engine accesses it immediately. And that's the other wonder of the internet, is the ability to instantly reference the right information. So it's really about who wants to learn and who wants to adopt information. And I think with any technology adoption curve, there'll be early adopters. We are all still early. There'll be mainstream adoption, and then there'll be laggards. And I say to people, you know, don't be the grandpa whose kids give you a phone just so they can contact you. You know, I think there will come a day when people will want to send you whatever form of value or money via blockchain, and you're not going to have a phone to do so. So it's always good to be educated for that. But the other bit is just to understand, I think there are unfortunate mishaps. I said on another podcast this week, there's a statistic doing the rounds that 4% of all Bitcoin is lost every year. Not destroyed, because you can't destroy Bitcoin, but it's lost because people lose the access to the Bitcoin. I mean, Bitcoin is on a blockchain, and you need to keep your private keys safe. If you're an exchange, then that is obviously automated for you. If you keep it on a cold storage wallet, then you're responsible for those passphrases. So those type of things, just understand those things very well before you go. You know, with a bank account, you can reset your password. Unfortunately, with a crypto and a private wallet, once you've lost that key, it's gone. And 4% is a lot. We talk about deflationary technology and deflationary supplies of assets. If you start compounding 4%, obviously at some stage that'll taper off a bit, but it's a big amount. We're not creating and mining 4% of Bitcoin at this stage.
Mm. A couple of questions for you on what you said just now. If I wanted to send 10 Rand to you, how much does that cost me if I use Binance platform?
So you'll have a 1 to 1.4% chance just to get it from fiat onto the Binance platform.
Yeah.
But let's work on the assumption you've got crypto and you want to send me crypto, then our commission rates are 0.1%. And on some of our products like Binance Pay in South Africa, that's still free. Mm. Because we want to get people to use that, what we call the B2C connection, business to consumer connection, where people actually pay for services or products using Binance Pay. And I've seen some very exciting developments lately. The guys at Carl von Weick et al. With their Lightning Network products and Pick and Pay. I thought that was a big breakthrough. And I hope we can see much more of that. That way you can just, there has always been this question in crypto, so how can I buy a bread with Bitcoin? You know, it's very simple, 0 to 1 movement, and that type of stuff comes forward. So, 0.1% on a peer-to-peer basis and for free when you use Binance Pay. And I think that's a very reasonable charge if you look at what other channels will
I was going to draw a comparison, and I was reading one of your recent sort of publications, one of the interviews that you did. I think it was on IT Web. You were talking about sort of the friction between sort of banks and crypto exchanges, and I think if you look at the costing model that you've got at Binance Pay versus PayShap or versus any of the other sort of payment methods with banks, I mean, you can see why they're a little bit anxious, that should we use the word. We're not going to go too deep into that. I did want to ask another question about buying bread with Bitcoin or any cryptocurrency.
Yeah.
As someone that holds cryptocurrency, and in my world, I hold crypto as a long-term asset. Okay, I think it's going to, again, no financial advice here. This is my personal view. I think that, you know, we will see inflation. I think we will see, you know, a rising in price and what have you. So I'm keeping it as a long-term asset. Would I then go to Pick and Pay or any retailer and spend my Bitcoin that I'm trying to save for an investment to go buy a loaf of bread or groceries or whatever it may be? What's the use case? Or again, from maybe this is a sort of personal view or a Binance view. I don't know if there is one, but how are you going to incentivize consumers to pay using something that could massively appreciate in value? So I could go and buy a loaf of bread today, and then in a week's time, if there's a huge spike and, you know, we go into a bull run market, I can go and buy probably half a shop, right? Or I can go buy a car with the same amount of money or tokens that it's cost me to buy a loaf of bread. So how does that work? What's kind of the view?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I think it gets to the crux of the matter is I don't want to put, we Binance don't want to put anybody in a position where you feel, now I need to go spend my Bitcoin because, we expect a bull run, we expect this to appreciate, all the arguments you make completely, but we subscribe to as well. So we don't want to do that. So the way we've configured our Binance Pay platform is you can take any asset in your portfolio, to pay a merchant, which will then receive in any coin or token of their preference. So this is what's fascinating. The exchange mechanism combines with a payment mechanism in a single transaction where everybody gets the value which they wish, or everybody either gives or receives value in the form that they wish to. And I think that's where it is truly fascinating.
So it's kind of interoperable. It's basically what it is, right? It's exactly. An interoperable system.
Interoperable, but to your preference, where you will on the Binance Pay app, you say, okay, go spend my Tether, my USDT first, then spend my BNB coin, then spend my Ethereum, then spend my Bitcoin. And if you don't want to spend your Bitcoin, you say that, and you just define which ones it goes through first. Yeah. That way you can, obviously, you'll have a balance on your crypto wallet, and you'll use it in that preference.
Yeah.
And I think that's through user's choice. And then obviously the merchants can choose how they select it. Now, most of them will still use rands because very simply your working capital cycles on rand, your suppliers are paid for in rands, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. And that freedom needs to exist as well. You know, if you take that freedom to choose the low-cost nature of it, and the duration. I mean, these things take 10 seconds. Bitcoin takes a bit longer. But our platform instances take anything to 10 seconds and, you know, the payment is made. So that puts it on par with a credit card. But you have that freedom to choose what value mechanism you hold, which value store you hold you want to exchange for other value. In other words, in this case, groceries. And I think that is real freedom.
Let's talk about paying for goods and services. Now, again, obviously, you know, you've got the Binance app, but are you, or is there any integrations with any other payments methods here in South Africa? So whether it be card, whether it be things like SnapScan, or whether it be sort of QR code based or anything like that, are there any interesting partners that you've had to sort of make here in South Africa in order to, you know, look at that whole sort of supply chain?
I think you've just given me a very good idea. We should speak to the folks at both Zap and SnapScan. I think adding crypto to that and enabling the Binance wallet to do that is truly fascinating. And this the technology I just described can do that, obviously. So we're always working on credit cards and many other parts of the world, especially the Middle East. You know, I think of Bahrain as a country specifically. You can use your Binance credit card to pay for services, for fuel, for groceries, whatever. We do need more general adoption by the banks because in South Africa, Visa and MasterCard rely on the banks to be the card issuer. Yeah. I don't see that changing anytime soon, but that's, I think, as we grow the adoption base, there's going to be more and more pressure from the users to say, well, I want a Absa credit card as well as a Binance credit card because I want to choose which one I spend with. You know, it's going to be like some of the loyalty points you got from some of the apparel retailers, et cetera, at some stage. It's that freedom of choice. Yep. So that will happen at some stage. But I think for now, we're just looking at other channels like, say, SnapScan is a very good example where I think this is entirely possible. And it gives them the opportunity to hold some crypto as well or not. If they choose not to, then that conversion happens automatically.
And then from an e-com perspective, obviously e-com is booming across the continent. We've seen obviously a massive increase since COVID or during COVID and then, you know, post-COVID. Is there a play there for Binance in terms of e-com payments?
Yes, I think for crypto generally, yes. I think where the real opportunity starts, because crypto is a decentralized technology, I think it's for some of the smaller merchants. I think in this case, you know, someone like SnapScan kind of preceded that journey where they did an excellent job of onboarding the smaller merchant, and they've opened e-commerce for smaller merchants at flea markets. I mean, Cape Town is well known for all the markets we have across the city, and this type of thing works really well. So you then look at what this does. I'm thinking, and I'm always the first one to say that, you know, South Africa, our payments mechanisms work really well. SnapScan, credit card, bank or phone-to-phone payment with some of the banks work really well. So on that basis, we need to remember we've got a very sophisticated financial market, which is a good thing. It works well. But the moment you pass a Limpopo, that stops. And I think that e-commerce basis where if you want to buy something in, say, Zimbabwe, you need someone on the crypto network to send money from South Africa to Zimbabwe There are firms who do that. I think there are shortcomings in those models. But of course, you have a fiat off-ramp on the other side, and people still trade physical dollars. It's the weirdest thing. You go to Zimbabwe and everybody's using the US currency. We know the reasons for that. But I think what that highlights to me is the real need for crypto in currencies like that. And as a firm, we see Nigeria, I mean, it's just crazy, the crypto adoption in that country. And wonderful craze in the sense that everybody uses it and it works really well. I mean, you just need to see some of the numbers every week and you realize it's real and it works. Mm-hmm. Back to the e-commerce bit is we're all aware of the retail adoption curve. We need to have, the next adoption curve will be the merchant adoption curve, where at some stage there's going to be pressure on the merchants as well to say, we will accept crypto. My message to all of them is that the technology exists so that you don't need to collect all these weird and wonderful coins and you have these things on the balance sheet that drives an accountant crazy from a valuation perspective.
Yeah.
Technology is there to convert it as you get it into the value store that you want. Mm. And again, that's freedom of money, you know. So it's not a case of a South African merchant getting money from Zimbabwe. We need to accept the Zim dollar in whichever format it exists these days. You can get it in the format that you want, and that immediate conversion is, I think, the key selling point.
I've got a question for you. I know we haven't scripted this, by the way. If anyone's listening, these are non-scripted questions. I'm just chucking questions at him, left, right, and center. So, Hannes, let's talk about a business case, right? Let's talk about my business, Talent in the Cloud. We invoice a customer, and the customer wants to pay us in cryptocurrency. Okay, we accept cryptocurrency. We have an account. That's fine. We bring that into our balance sheet. How do we then quantify the revenue on that number? Because depending on which day or which hour in the day, that number is very different. How would SARS, as an example, how would SARS then look at it from corporation tax and look at it in terms of monetary value? Do they do it just on the invoice on basically it was 50,000 Rand and that's 50,000 Rand, and whether, you know, at the point of you converting that to fiat, to Rand, if there is a gain, then you pay the capital gain against that. How does that work?
Okay, it's more in the tax domain, but my understanding of it is that obviously you will still invoice your customer in a Rand.
The Rand value.
With a Rand invoice. So you can make it payable in crypto, and you can define which coins you want, because you don't want all of them. But I think if you look at the top 20, most of those are solid. So let's say you want to receive it in Solana or BNB coin or Ethereum, then that's what you do. But I think obviously your VAT will be determined on your invoice value.
Yep.
But you will then have what we referred to in the beginning as that financial asset on your balance sheet, which you need to take a view on. So now you have crypto on your balance sheet. You mean you have someone like Michael Saylor of MicroStrategy saying, this becomes his reserve asset. He's got a lot of Bitcoin on his balance sheet to a point where MicroStrategy becomes a quasi-proxy for Bitcoin. Right. And Bitcoin becomes a quasi-proxy for MicroStrategy. So he's taken a view that this will be my value store. This will be the medium in which I hold it. Obviously, every firm and every board needs to decide how they want to do that. I think it's a payment mechanism. Again, the flexibility exists to convert it instantaneously into the value store of your choice.
Sure.
You can hedge against it. This is where the derivative products fees come in. You can hedge against it. But once you've got that on your balance sheet, the option is certainly there to convert it to whichever medium your board has agreed to.
Very interesting. So we've spoken about peer-to-peer payments. We've spoken about retail and e-com. We've spoken about business payments, so on the commercial side. Let's talk about remittance for a moment. It seems every day there's a new remittance company that's popped up that's servicing Africa. I mean, you look in the UK, Canada, and in the US at the moment, literally it's daily. Everyone is kind of popping up these new MTOs. Mm. Where is the business model for, or the utilization of cryptocurrency for cross-border remittance?
I think that's one of, in the African context, I think it's one of the most important facets of it. South Africans, we need to remember that Africa is about migrant labor, and a lot of people travel across the continent, either north towards Europe or south towards South Africa, for jobs. And very often family members stay behind in the original country. And as people travel in one direction, almost always the value travels in the opposite direction as you send money home to people. And that has just become excruciatingly expensive. I mean, slow and expensive, because in the end, a lot of people are looking to gain efficiencies from a system that ultimately still uses the dollar as a reserve currency. And you basically go rand, dollar, dollar, Kenyan shilling. But the dollar is still the reserve currency, and that all still goes to New York and their various clearing systems. So it's not made to be efficient. It's designed for other purposes, and it's got bolt-ons now, like obviously anti-money laundering, et cetera, et cetera. So it's not made for efficiency, where crypto is made for efficiency. And I think once you see users, more and more people adopt this, and we do see a very healthy level of adoption, which is encourageable. So that'll certainly make things easier. I mean, I think this is the magic of crypto, where if you have someone, a family member in Zimbabwe, and they on the Binance platform as well with the Binance wallet, it's almost instantaneous to send it. The issue is, and I'll be the first to acknowledge this, is the off-ramp into either fiat or to a merchant who accepts it. That is our next frontier that we need to fight. But once you've got that bit sorted out, that's what we've all been after. So that's for me the key functionality of it.
Using in that user case, if I'm in Zim and I'm receiving money from my wife or whoever it may be, my uncle in South Africa, and they're sending me, let's just make it simple, one Bitcoin, right? Can I convert that on Binance into fiat and then put that into my bank account?
In the countries where we do fiat, yes. So that right. becomes a part of the value chain that is out of our control. So yes, in a lot of countries we can do that. In the countries that we don't, you can obviously change it into a stable coin and send that to another crypto user via stable coin. And obviously your better stable coins are all at least one-to-one backed. Some of them more. So you've got that opportunity as well. But yeah, I mean, the fiat world is outside of our control and not always something you can change. In South Africa, you can do that. So if you have someone in Zim with crypto and they've got a family member in South Africa, that family member can connect to the fiat world and get it into lands.
I guess this brings us back to the beginning part of the conversation, though, because, you know, with the exchange controls here in South Africa, they are very tight. How does one navigate that as a consumer? So if I'm sending, say, over a million rand to my cousin in Zim, the onus is on me to declare that to SARS, is it? Yeah.
Yes, okay. It is. It forms part of your single discretionary allowance. But yeah, we do ask everybody to make sure you are familiar with the facts and the regulations. That forms part of your million, and then you can obviously apply for, I think, another 10.
Yeah.
But yes, yeah, people please need to note that the onus is on the South African user to make sure that you do all the right things.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Good. And then I suppose in your annual returns, if you have made any profits or you've cashed in your coins, then you need to declare that for capital gains purposes.
Yeah. Obviously, the moment you send it, that no longer your property then by virtue of how it works. So if you send your uncle, then that part, okay, two things happen. A, you need to make sure you declare it from an exchange control perspective, but also the moment you send it, if you have made a profit, then that'll trigger either your capital gains tax or your marginal tax. So yeah, okay. Again, people asking everybody to please familiarize themselves.
Be aware. Absolutely. So I thought this conversation was going in so many different directions. I really did. I had the article, which I'm actually going to post. If anyone's watching this on YouTube, in the comments below, I'm going to post an article that Hannes sort of did for IT Web. Really, really interesting. It's about Hannes's journey from working in corporate banking to then being in this crazy world of crypto and fintech. And I was going to talk a little bit more about that, but he I'm not going to cover the same stuff that he's already covered. So I thought we'd delve a bit deeper into, user cases around crypto. I think it's super interesting. There was one thing I wanted to pick up, though, and it's not controversial at all, I promise. But your journey, I'm fascinated by this. Your journey from HSBC, a very senior role in HSBC, then moving into this crazy world of fintech and crypto and Binance. I'm not going to ask you what the difference is, because I think you covered that in your article, right? But what's been the biggest eye-opener for you?
The crypto world at this stage is still far less regulated, and the banking world is very regulated. So in the banking world, there's a lot of emphasis to make sure you stay on the right side of a lot of regulators. So people are always triangulating for what could be your risks. And the consequence of that is you develop a very, very good risk framework. Something HSBC did excellently, you know. So there's a very good risk framework, but it takes a big part of your day. Where crypto is very much about the user adoption. I'm just contrasting HSBC's business model is that of a multinational bank, amongst other things, in South Africa. So you've got a smaller client set where this is a retail organization, and it's about getting people on board, and it's about educating people, getting them on board responsibly, and getting them transact responsibly. So very different in that sense. So in terms of innovating in that, the pace is a lot higher. In the banking world, you live and die by your email. You know, everybody sends each other email because that's your medium of information exchange. In the crypto world, it's all about messenger platforms. So, you know, I look at my email about twice a day, and then the rest of the time is all about your messaging platform. And Binance has developed a very good internal messaging platform. It's very secure because the information needs to be secure. Those are the differences. I think the parallels are very much information security is very important. We've developed a very, very secure website and general platform. And then also the way you treat information is important. So having work on the investment banking side, you know, you sometimes work on transactions where the information is highly restricted. You come into the crypto world, you think, okay, well, those days are gone. And day one, you realize, no, they're not gone. There's a lot of information in the crypto sphere, especially about new projects and stuff that is not yet public and need to be treated with that information embargoes that treats everybody fairly. So that was quite interesting to see. And it's good to see. I mean, Binance does this excellently as well. So just treating that information in the right way.
Last question, and then we'll wrap. You mentioned in your article, again, I'm going to post this down there, but the risk appetite. You were talking about the risk appetite between sort of banks and the world of sort of crypto and fintech. Can you unpack that a little bit? What did you mean by that? Because I think people, again, going back to the sort of point I made a bit earlier on about, you know, FTX, and, you know, there was a bit of uncertainty and there was a bit of nervousness around the market. Mm. And then sort of read that, you know, there's a different risk appetite. Oh, what did you actually mean by that? I just wondered whether you could just elaborate.
Sure. No, it's hopefully a relatively easy one. So I think in the case of a bank, so maybe if you lend money out, you lend someone else's money.
Yeah.
So you need to be very careful to do or to make a loan that you are sure you're going to get the money back. Otherwise, you know, there's always a deposit on the other side that's not going to get their money back.
Sure.
But obviously the bank takes the loss first through their capital mechanism. But because you've got South Africa capital adequacy of, well, in the region of 10%, depending on how you interpret Basel II advanced, then you know, that 10% can only absorb so many losses, and then you need to start going to your deposit saying, sorry, we can't pay you back. And that causes chaos, as we all know.
Yep.
Crypto exchange, and especially Binance, works different, where we are custodian for those assets. And while we have something like the Binance End product, where you can stake your own money to a protocol of your choice, we don't lend that stuff out. So, and that's what happened at FTX, that very sacred barrier between first party and third party funds need to be respected at all times. Now the banks do that well, but you still take money from one entity to another. That's the bank's business. There's nothing wrong with it. But you've got to have a very good defined risk appetite statement and philosophy to make sure you don't get into the wrong areas. Whereas crypto, you need to make sure that you know and you understand the exchange on which you deal. That is important because in the case of FTX, not everything was transparent. And we now know that some of the money went where it shouldn't have gone, and that what I call the sacred barrier between the first and third party funds was violated. And then bad things happened. So it's very different. I think, again, someone asked me the week, do we see Binance becoming a bank at some stage? No, we're an exchange. Please think of us more as a combination between a stockbroker and a stock exchange.
Yeah.
You know, we're custodian because you have to be custodian if you exchange. Otherwise, people exchange stuff and where does it go? You know, someone's got to keep it.
Sure.
But that type of clarity and transparency will also become very important in the future. And I think FTX has shown that. I also refer people to our CoinMarketCap website that shows the exchanges, how big they are, what volumes they trade, how many assets they've got on their balance sheet. And a true test of an exchange is your ability to, well, the scenario where your users withdraw all the assets from your exchange and you continue to exist. And during that crisis, I mean, I remember our founders said that you guys are honestly welcome to withdraw your crypto, even if it's just for me to prove to you that we haven't lent it out. Take right. it if you want to. And I remember we were at about $56 billion at some stage. We went down to 35, and I haven't checked again lately, but it's probably over $60 billion worth of crypto on the exchange. You know? So it's just that custody function. But that's the difference between the two. And as an exchange, you can't violate that custody trust that's been put in you because, then things go bad quickly.
So I think if I can, again, just summarize what you're saying, you know, if there was a bank run on Binance platform, it would make no difference. The platform would still be exactly. able to cope because, you are a custodian of my money. Again, not knocking banks, obviously, they have a very important role to play in financial services. But if there was a run in, on the banks, as we've seen in other countries over the last 10, 15 years, when civil war breaks out or something happens and there's a big run, there's a liquidity problem there, right? Because that money is not necessarily, whilst it may be showing in your online banking or on your phone, it's not actually there. That's just, not the ones and zeros.
Well, it's just two sides of a ledger crypto is also two sides of a ledger, but the crypto doesn't get lent out. So again, this is nothing against the banking platform. It merely aims to contrast the two, the difference between the two.
Yeah.
Both have got a perfectly rational place in this world. We all still have bank accounts. But the South African banks have always been formidable in the way they manage their capital adequacy. The big four, which now become the big five, very solid from a capital adequacy perspective. They've got a regulator that's, again, formidable and has an excellent reputation in terms of managing that. So the moment that goes wrong, our economy will be in big, big trouble. But it's not. It's honestly, it's a very good and sophisticated industry. The crypto industry, for me, is parallel to that, but it augments it in a way where the moment you go cross-border, the system doesn't work that well. And unfortunately, you need another outlet for that. And I think crypto does that very well.
So it's just solving the off-ramp. If that can be solved, then there's massive use cases. I was going to ask you about XRP and Ripple, but that's one for another time, eh? Listen, Hannes, thank you so, so much. I've learned loads. I'm sure people listening to this have learned loads as well. As I said, I'm going to put a few links in the comments here on YouTube. I'm going to put the link to the Binance Academy. We're going to put the link to, I think, the coin cap, market cap in terms of... CoinMarket, thank you. So people can keep an idea on that. If anyone wants to look you up, Hannes, is LinkedIn the best place for you these days? Or are you a Twitter fan? Or are you on Threads these days? I mean,
I've not activated that yet. I think it's well known that CZ was an investor in the privatization of Twitter, so I'm going to stay on Twitter for now.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, me too. I haven't got the headspace for another social media platform.
It needs to add incremental value before I look at it.
Yeah, I agree.
That's my view for now.
Well, listen, thanks so much. I'll let you get back to your day in Cape Town. Great to have you on. Thanks for your time. Thanks for your insights. And we'll catch up again very soon.
Thank you very much, Dan. Thanks, everybody, for your time.
And that's a wrap for this week's episode of Talking Success. Thank you so much for tuning in and joining us for this fascinating discussion on all things fintech. We hope you've enjoyed this episode and have gained some valuable insights into the ever-evolving world of finance and technology. A huge thank you to our guests for sharing their expertise and providing us with some amazing insights. We certainly couldn't have done this without them. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and stay tuned for more exciting conversations with experts in the field. Until next time, keep learning, keep growing, and keep talking success.